Yeah, anyway, it's a great pleasure to give this talk because the last time when George had his workshop here, he said I should come and give a talk on Hesiodus. Well, it hasn't launched and there's nothing to talk about. And he said, come and try to generate some interest. And so we came down and gave a talk then. But this talk is much more satisfying to give. We actually have data to show. So anyway, let's get started, and let me just say that the sun is the most powerful particle accelerator in the solar system. It accelerates ions up to tens of GeV and electrons up to hundreds of MeV in at least two kinds of processes. Solar flares, which turn out to be the most powerful explosions in the solar system, well, releases 10 to the 32 exponent 32 and 10 to the 33 ergs in 10 to 1,000 seconds. And that's roughly 1 billion megatons of TNT. So it's an enormous amount of energy. It's released, but what's really interesting about this is our observations up to now indicate that a large fraction of that energy comes out in high-energy particles. The electrons from 10 to 100 kilovolts contain somewhere between 10 and 50% of this energy, current estimates, and the ions may contain a comparable amount of energy. So remarkably, these explosions are primarily, most of the energy seems to go into particle acceleration. Nobody understands how that happens. The other process, which appears to also accelerate particles to that kind of energy, are these very fast CMEs. And these eject 10 to the 15 to 10 to the 16 grams in a time out from the sun. They're a slower process, so I don't think of them so much as an explosion. And these seem to be done by shocks, although when we see these shocks finally pass by us at 1 AU, we never see acceleration anything close to those energies. So I'm going to talk about the flares. That's what HESI's designed to do. And when you're looking at high-energy electrons and ions at the sun, you look at to see them, you look at the emissions that they produce, and the electrons produce hard X-ray and gamma-ray continuum through bremsstrahlung, and the ions produce nuclear lines through nuclear collisions, and here I show an old slide. The dark lines, then the solid lines, are the bremsstrahlung continuum in the 35 to 114 kilovolt band. And the dashed lines, then, are this nuclear lines, which dominate in the 4 to 6 MeV range. And what you can see here, this is only 1 minute from here to here, is that you have time variations which the ions, electrons seem to track of a scale of seconds. And then, yes, good. And the triangles now are the hot plasma that's produced in the flare, sort of 10 to 20 million degree plasma. So, and this just says the same thing. At low energies, you're looking at the hot plasma. In here, you're looking at the bremsstrahlung from electrons. And then the nuclear line component produced by nuclear collisions gives you dominates in this energy range, and gives you, is a signature of the ions, accelerated ions. Now, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about here, 10 to the 32 ergs in 1,000 seconds is about 10 to the 29 ergs per second. If you get that in electrons, you're talking about 10 to the 36 electrons per second, which means you empty the entire flare loop in a time scale of a second. That's also a current, equivalent current of about 10 to the 17 amps. And before SMM, most theorists said, that's impossible. This must be thermal emission. If we combine the plasma at, say, 10 to the 8 degrees, then one electron collides with another electron. It's just exchanging energy between the electrons, and then collision losses aren't a problem, and so you don't need nearly as much energy. And of course, this isn't the first measurement, but when imaging of hard X-rays came in, They found, of course, almost all the X-rays were coming from these foot points, which were in a region where you also got H-alpha brightening, EUV brightening, which clearly indicated that region was low temperature relative to the energy electron. So that right away told you that you couldn't, that thermal explanation wasn't gonna explain what we saw. So you really had a process where you had a huge amount of energy being released in high energy particles. Now, the nice thing about Bremsstrahlen is we think we understand the process pretty well. And if you have a, say, 50 kilovolt electron, of course, it produces X-rays from its energy all the way down to at any energy below it. And these are cross sections from a summary by, I've forgotten people's name in reviews of modern physics. But these cross sections are known to sort of order 10%.
Kock and Mott's,
right. Right. And so we thought if we made good enough measurements of the X-rays, we might be able to unfold the X-ray spectrum and get to the electron spectrum. And here's sort of the scheme. Supposing we have a certain amount, supposing this is the observed X-ray spectrum, and then these X-rays are produced by electrons of higher energy than this. Those electrons, if we said those were the only electrons in the system, then we could say, what did they produce at lower energies? That was this. We subtract that from the observed spectrum, and then we get this chunk, which must have been produced by electrons of energy between this and this, and so forth. And we could work our way down. This, of course, isn't very good if the spectrum's flat because the errors get so huge. You're looking at subtractions of two large numbers. But when we got these very high spectral resolution measurements, and that's really important, it's very hard to make this kind of subtraction without that. When we got the first high resolution measurements from a balloon, we saw that it had sort of a double power law shape, then a thermal component at low energies. We were able to do this and return the X-ray producing electrons. And then if you made some assumptions about how the electrons were losing their energy, and of course for us the obvious assumption was that they were losing energy by Coulomb collisions, then you could actually get back to the accelerated spectrum. And what we found was that there were really two components in this flare. There was a slow component which had a roughly power law, this blue spectrum, and then there was a fast spiky component whose spectrum was very flat at low, had a kink and it was very flat below the break, and that could be explained by essentially something that was peaked. So, and we could actually do a little more with this. If you take the X-ray emission here in different energy bands here, you could now calculate this as a function of time, and what, and this just says sort of the same thing that we said in the last part. There was a smooth component which didn't produce any of these spikes in the X-rays, but then when you got to higher energies, you saw these spikes come up. So these are the actual accelerated electrons as a function of time for this particular event. And the fact that you only saw the spikes, the electrons at the spikes, meant that the spiky X-rays were all produced by electrons above about 50 kilovolts. So, of course, that got us to thinking, how could we do this more generally? That I just show here just a whole series of spectra we've had at the spikes. There are all these double power law kinds of spectra, although the statistics weren't that good. And so we realized that you could do something really nice if you could get good measurements, and that was you could go from the X-ray. If you had X-ray observations that were spatially resolved, then you could infer the electron spectrum at each point as a function of time, and then you could solve the continuity equation to get the source term, which is the accelerated term with the and the location. So you could see where the electrons were accelerated and get their spectrum. And at the same time, you could verify the losses, actually. So again, for that, you would need to know the density and magnetic field and all that kind of thing in the region. So that was part of the motivation behind HESI. And the other part was, of course, to look at gamma rays, which would allow you to get information about the ions. So the idea then was to get not just imaging, but also spectroscopy, imaging spectroscopy, imaging and spectroscopy at every point in the image. And the problem, of course, is that this is relatively easy to do at optical or soft X-ray EUV energies because you could use focusing optics. And so you have things bounce off a mirror or you use a lens or something. But at the energies we wanted to look at, sort of in the 10 to kV to 10 MeV range, photons just didn't bounce very well and you couldn't make that kind of optics. So what we did instead was we used a set of grids. So this is sort of like an equivalent of a pinhole camera. We used basically blocked X-rays by using two identical grids. And so if you use two identical grids, then you can see that photons coming in from some angles will be able to get through and be detected by your detector. And then if they're a little bit further over, they get blocked by one or the other of the grids. And now if you move this grid relative to the source, you would get a modulation pattern. And what we actually do is spin the grids. That is, we spin the whole spacecraft. And that modulation pattern then can be deconvolved to give you imaging. And so that's what we have here. So we have the two sets of nine grids with the detectors back here to get the spectroscopy. These are germanium detectors, which have resolution of the order of a kilovolt. And they can have response up to 17 MeV. These have to be cooled to liquid nitrogen temperatures. So we use a Stirling cycle cooler to do that. This whole thing is in a spacecraft that spins. We get these kind of modulation patterns. Those modulation patterns can be reconstructed to give you the image. Okay. So if we make these grids thick enough, of course, they can get up to high energies. But to get the field of view so we always see the sun, we required a 1-degree field. That means the very finest grids only go up to about 100 or so kilovolts. The thick ones, of course, go all the way up in energy. So let me, and this is just to indicate if you had a point source and in different configurations, different if it's a large, then you get these kinds of modulation patterns. So it turns out all of this is worked out because it's essentially equivalent to interferometry for radio astronomy. So on our team are several radio astronomers, and all these deconvolution techniques have been worked out. Use clean and maximum entropy and pixons and all that kind of stuff. So this shows you what the front of the telescope looks like. These are tungsten grids. In the case of the thickest ones, they're 3 centimeters thick, so they can stop pretty much up into the 10 MeV range. The finest grid is molybdenum. I think it's this one. And then these three are three lenses which project an image of the sun back on three linear CCDs, which allow us to get the limbs of the sun to an arc second or so, better than an arc second. And by combining the three, and we make this measurement a minimum of 16 times a second, so we can actually get our position on the sun to better than a fraction of an arc second. And in fact, these particular things turn out to maybe be useful for studies of sun, because we actually measure the sun's radius 16 times a second. And it's very accurate. When you do the analysis, actually, it turns out to be a small, very small fraction of a second. And then these are the nine grids.
Can you measure those
lasers? Yeah, actually you can. So there's a graduate student who's working on that, and And that has turned out to be as good as we thought. So.
Well, can I ask for the higher energy gamma rays?
Yes.
There's, I presume, a lot of confidence scattering still. So
there is. We aren't that good for real high energies. We're really better at about up to about the 2.2 MeV line for many reasons. I mean, the detectors aren't big enough and so forth, and we don't have any shielding. But remember, the sun is bright, and a big flare will be okay. And of course, for lines, if they do Compton scatter, then we see that. So, by the energy shift. So, So this shows you from the side. There's a set of grids up here. There's a set of grids in the back plus the CCDs, and this is a graphite epoxy tube. One thing to note in when we look at the way this thing works is that clearly it doesn't matter if the grid moves out this way parallel to it. So that's not a problem. We don't have to worry about keeping that. And going this direction doesn't really matter because we mount our telescopes, our optical telescopes on that. So that measures that. The only thing we're really afraid of is twist of one relative to another. And that's why this graphite epoxy thing, it keeps the twist really low. We have not had a problem. So what this allows us to do, actually, is do arc-second imaging with pointing that's only a fraction of a degree. So that actually is very, very nice. So, and the other part of that, of course, is we take every photon and time it to a microsecond and then give its energy and bring it down. So at that specific time, we can tell exactly where the telescope is pointing and so forth. Okay. Now, this compares HESI with what was done before. On the bottom is energy from 1 kilovolt to 10 MeV. HESI actually goes to 17 MeV. On the side here, we show the angular resolution from 1 arc seconds, 10, 100, and 1,000. YOCO, which is the only hard X-ray, which is the previous hard X-ray telescope, gives you four energy bands here and covers from about 6 or 7 arc seconds to about 40 or so arc seconds. And then YOCO's SXT, a focus optics device, of course, gets down to a couple arc seconds and makes real pictures. And then HESI here has this kind of coverage. And of course, this depends on the thickness of the tungsten. And then these two grids are very thick, so we can do the gamma ray imaging with these. But the other thing to notice is that we get this imaging with kilovolt resolution, and as I'll show you, getting that combination of high spectral resolution and spatial resolution is really pretty exciting. So here are the germanium detectors. There are 9 of them. They're about 7.1 centimeter diameter by 8.5. So the total volume of germanium here is much bigger than ever flown before. In fact, it's about the same size as what will fly an integrate. And because this is a SMEX, it means we don't have a lot of weight, so we haven't shielded this. And as Lars pointed out, well, you know, our Compton responses, and so we see most of these things Compton scattering out of our detectors. But the positive part of that is we also see cosmic bursts, and I'm pretty sure we'll be able to do things like look at the 1809 line, the 511 line, and of course any transients. We're using a Stirling cycle mechanical cryocooler because then if everything works, we don't have any expendables. We could, in principle, let this thing run for a very long time. And this shows you the cryostat. These are the electronics for the germanium. And on top here, we have two sets of attenuators. So these are disks that move in and out. The sun has an incredible dynamic range. We look at things from microflares to nanoflares up to X-class flares, and that's 7 or 8 orders of magnitude. And any normal electronics and detector can't handle all of that. So these attenuators move in and out in front of the detector depending on the counting rate. And that allows us to get pretty optimal response everywhere from microflares up to large X-class flares. This shows you the resolution in spectral resolution, energy resolution versus energy. And these dots here are the expected widths of the gamma ray lines that one gets from solar flares. Up here in the blue and the green are the instruments that have been flown before. And red here is our resolution. And what you can see is that the instruments that had flown before, none of them had resolution that was better than the width of the lines. While in our case, basically every line we do better than the line width except for the deuterium line. This slide shows you the spacecraft sitting in the fairing of the rocket. And of course, to get to this point, we underwent a number of problems. First of all, when we first got our spacecraft together and went to vibrate it for environmental tests, they shook it. They gave us 25 Gs instead of 2 Gs. It broke the spacecraft. And we fixed it and put it back together and got it into the rocket. And then the rocket started having problems. And the net result was we were supposed to launch in July of 2000. We didn't launch till February of this year. So we had a year and a half plus delay. And the last time I was down here, I think that was a week before launch or something, and we still weren't sure we'd actually get off. But this is looking from the airplane, and there's the rocket going off into the distance. And after all those problems with the launch vehicle, the launch was absolutely perfect. It went into a 600-kilometer altitude orbit. It ranges from 585 to 600. It's at 38 degrees inclination. That's just so that we can take it over Berkeley. And that's because at Berkeley, we've got a ground station where we bring the data down and we operate the spacecraft, command it from there. So we're pretty much in full control of the entire mission. This is just simulation of what happens. It gets launched, the solar panels go out, it spins up and it faces the sun. All of that happened on February 5th. We turned the coolers on then. And a week later, it was cold enough, we started taking data. This just gives you a background spectrum. These are background lines in germanium. These are 1 kilovolt bins, so you can see we're getting 1 kilovolt full width half max resolution. Here's the 511 line. It has a natural width of a couple of kilovolts, seeing it beautifully. So things look pretty good.
What's that background from?
That background is partly from the atmosphere, partly from stuff around in the spacecraft. So, and in fact, this. No, it's not on here. We saw a line at about 11 kilovolts, which puzzled us for a while. It is germanium. It turns out it's due to South Atlantic anomaly, low energy, not low energy relative to cosmic ray protons getting through and hitting the germanium. Previous experiments like HeO3 had big shields around them, so they didn't see the low energy protons. They didn't see that line very strongly, but we do. So. Okay, let me show you some data. This is, on the top I plotted GOES. Down here is the HESI data, just pure spectroscopy, essentially. And at the bottom is radio emission from the wind spacecraft. And this here is rapidly drifting burst. This is going from high to low frequencies. It's a solar type-free radio burst produced by electrons escaping from the sun. One of the things that's always puzzled us is that when we compare the electrons that we see in the interplanetary medium with the ones from the X-ray bursts, we always find the X-ray bursts need about 1,000 times the electrons that get out. It's only 0.1% of the electrons seem to get out. And I'm just showing this to show you that, in fact, these events often have a precursor here, and it's the precursor that's producing the type 3. And then you get the main event, and it's apparently some kind of a trapped kind of event. So the type 3s are actually these things. One of the reasons we can see it is because our we actually are able to bring our get response in our detectors down to 3 keV. And so you can see here that most of this is at 10 kilovolts or so.
But are you saying that you can see below where people thought there was a cutoff before?
Which cutoff?
Well, I mean, is there no energy in electrons below 8 kilovolts?
This is actually with our attenuator in. That's what's cutting it off. Let me explain. The two attenuators, one attenuator basically cuts us off around 8 kilovolts and lower. And when we first launched it, we launched it with that attenuator in. And later on, we popped it out. I'll show you some of that later. Now, what happened in the past is people who were looking at hard X-rays would put enough aluminum in front of their detector so that they didn't see stuff below about 20 or 25 kilovolts. Because if they didn't do that, the thermal X-rays from a flare are so intense that they would saturate the detector. So if you wanted to make hard X-ray measurements, and partly that's because of the resolution. But anyway, then if you wanted to look at the thermal X-rays, you would make something that had a small geometric factor so you wouldn't get saturated. And so it turned out that this range between about 3 and 20 hasn't really been looked at very carefully at all. And with our attenuator and our high spectral resolution, we've been making lots of measurements of that. So. Yeah, they're real. For some reason, well, let me show you this in a little blown up. Same thing. Here are X-ray time plots now. Here you can see quite clearly the two separation. Here's the radio emission from Arnold Benz's stuff. So you can see now here, this is the radio event that comes out and becomes a type 3. And we've seen a fair number of these now. Although we often see type 3s that don't seem to go back to anything, too. But this is fairly not uncommon for us to see this kind of precursor. Sometimes we see just a faint increase here, especially at these lower energies in a type 3. So my guess is that now we're actually, for the first time, seeing the real X-rays from the type 3 electrons. This is just a blow up even further, and here you can see this maybe at one here and one here that eventually come down.
And the light curves at the very top are?
Those are actually count rates.
Those are count rates.
In different energies.
Energy
right. So it's the same data as this, just quantitatively. So you can see what this is, an 8 to 10 kilovolt channel or something like that. Here's a big flare, this is about a C6 or C7 flare, so it's not even an M flare. This is the one, so here's the GOES data, here's our data in a spectrogram form. So you can see this this stuff starting up early before the main event, and then the sudden flash stuff going up to almost 100 kilovolts. And the radio emission actually lines up exactly with that, these two here. And here's the type 3 coming out here. So this one, I don't know if there's a precursor for this, but this is the one we decided to try to look at more carefully. Here is several energy channels. This one's 3 to 26 keV, 27 to 50, 51 to 74. 75 to 99. And again, you see this stuff building up beforehand, this spike of very high energies, going to high energies, and then this long decay. We did a spectrum just for this part here between the two dashed lines. These are 1 kilovolt energy bins now. There's a slight thermal component rising up here. You can see this very nice power law here, a break. The power law is 3.2 below a break at about 45 kilovolts here. And if you look carefully, this break happens on a scale of about 10 kilovolts. And then so it's a double power law, the break. Now, those of you, if you remember the Bremsstrahlen cross sections I showed you at the start, it is not easy to make a break. You need something that's very abrupt, either a peak in the spectrum, or very abrupt change in the spectrum to do that. And of course, this kind of stuff you'd never be able to resolve in a simulator. Now, for some reason, these kinds of spectra of the we've only looked at a few flares, but they always seem to come out this double power law with a break.
Did you break one?
It's 3.2 to 4.3. In this case, it's about 1. There's some others where it's not.
Maybe Bahi remembers that. I can't remember the old story about particle cooling. You get a break. I mean, aging. It's the old, you know, I've forgotten.
You say, in this case, 1.5. You put a primitive cell in 1.5.
Yeah, yeah. But I'll show you some other breaks that are not 1. So. This shows you image. This is the spectrum for that time interval, summed over all area, right? So now, this is what we put together for the press conference. We took 40 seconds of data and made maps at different energies. Now look at the energy bins, 12 to 14, 14 to 16, 16 to 18, 18 to 20, 20 to 22. These are 2 kilovolt energy bins.
And this is a C flare.
This is a C flare, yeah. And what you see is you see an elongated blob at the lowest energies resolving out to 2 foot points by the time you get to higher energies. And you know, we thought we understood this. This is a loop, right? And the top is hot, and the bottom are where the electrons go down and hit the.
Where on the sun was this?
This is near the limb, actually. Yeah, see, there's a guy who knows what's going on. So it shouldn't be like this, right? It should be tilted if the loop is coming up straight. Here, the superimposed 50% maximum. So 30 to 80 kilovolts are 2 foot points. They're slightly bigger at 26 to 30. At the lower energies, you see it go out like this. And we did some spectra. And this is the kind of imaging spectroscopy we wanted to do. The amazing part, foot point 1 and foot point 2 almost lie on top of each other, e to the minus 3.5. In between, there seems to be more thermal spectrum. So everyone understands this. You've got a hot thermal source. You've got a single source of electrons. The electrons come down the two sides and hit the That was some discussions between us and the press people got this in there. They didn't want to see these numbers. You know, this is, let's see. This whole thing is about, I have to go back. I don't remember the, okay, these are in arc seconds here, okay? So you can see the thing is about 40 arc seconds, right? Yeah. On the
south.
That's on the northwest limb, actually. This thing I flipped. This has been flipped. We didn't do this.
What is the dynamic range of the mapping here?
Let me talk about that later. You'll see. Okay. So we thought at this point we understood things, and then after we got this stuff for the press release, then we started slicing and dicing it in different ways. I want to show you some of that. Here now is a sequence in time. This is 4 seconds, roughly, per. This is at 12 to 14 kilovolts. So here you can see the burst started about 06. So it starts at 05. So around here is when the main hard X-ray burst is. So at 12 to 14, you see what looks like a single hot something other suddenly getting brighter here. Now you're beginning to see some elongation in this. Look, notice here, there's something here. Now, we're not always sure how much to believe these, but when we get several different energy channels showing the same thing, then we begin to believe it. You can see it's still here, this one, and you can see the separation. This is about the end of the hard X-ray spike. And now suddenly you see this strong, hot central peak comes along. OK. This is 4 seconds. I'm sorry?
4 seconds. That is a 4 second.
4 seconds, roughly, per. Roughly 1 spin period. So again, at 14 to 16, you see this coming along. But now you see the elongation more here. And you see here this bottom point seems to go up and then suddenly shifts to this upper point. And then the central thing, then sometimes was a little bit more. 16 to 18, you see again, this bottom one starts first. Well, maybe not. It's still here, up to here. Um, 18 to 20, now you see again this the same upper point showing up, this bottom one brightening, and then later on the upper one brightening. And then at 18 to 20, it sort of dies out later on. At 20 to 25, it's quite clear this bottom one comes first, and then the upper one brightens. So all this idea about the same population coming down, it's not that, because they're actually different in time. And even more pronounced here, the upper one. And look, this thing is there again.
Is this surprising that the time integrated spectrum is exactly the same, but when you look at it?
Yeah, I know. As I said, we didn't do this till after. At first we thought, oh, we've got the explanation for this, but it's not at all right. Again, same thing. You can see this bottom point brighten and go away, and then the top point comes in.
So, Bob, this is the character of the noise when you get down?
Yeah. Remember, this is a 4-second interval, so we're beginning to reach our photon statistics limit. Yeah. Yeah. We could have cleaned this for you, but it did.
I'm just curious to know how this happened.
Yeah. Remember, we're deconvolving these spinning things, right? Okay. So, and then even at 35 to 40, now you're really beginning to be hard pressed to pick these out from the noise, but here I think you can see it pretty clearly.
So and the publicly available software will just generate these?
Yeah, I think so. This is generated using back projection and clean. And that's there.
The SSW package?
It's part of the SSW package. Now, some people are better at using it than others. This was done by Sam Crocker, who's a radio astronomer. He does. I don't think I could have done it. Okay. This just shows you some of the 8 to 10 with the 25 to 30 superimposed. So here's 25 to 30. You can see the 8 to 10 does seem to be in between. And you can see this seems to disappear, the 25 to 30, and now you're seeing this bright central point come up.
Seconds for it to switch from one foot point
to the other foot point. It's assuming those are foot points, right? And this is 6 to 8. We actually go down. The shutter was in, so 6 to 8 was about our limit.
For what is the angle resolution?
Right now, this is not even using the two finest grids. This is about six arc seconds.
So the 7 6.
I believe that's why I don't have it here, but I believe it's 64 arc seconds by 64 arc seconds. Yeah. And this shows you at 12 to 14. So now you're beginning to see more of the foot points in the 12 to 14. But again, look, when the foot points seem to have just about disappeared, that's when this hot central source shows up. Here we've rotated it, so now it's really this is really the northwest limb now. These splotches are EIT, the EIT telescope on SOHO. So it's an extreme ultraviolet telescope. We believe this is a loop in the EIT image. Here are two foot points. They do seem to be on the ends of the loop. This is that source that was on this side, the very weak source. So we think this is an on top loop source. And remember, afterwards, we were seeing very bright emission here. And if you believe that's the loop, then what is this bright emission? I don't know what it is. It's something else. But it seems it's the strongest thing at the end, by far.
It's not on the top of it.
It's between the two. I can go back and show you. But
the limb is same here, right?
Yeah, the limb is like this, and this side is, this is the loop top source. So, because we had rotated, when we rotated it back over. But if you go back to the original, there, you see the bright parts in between the two foot points. Okay. So we thought we had a pat explanation for the press conference, and that turns out to be completely wrong. So don't believe that. This is another flare. You can see it's actually several events. And when we, this is without the background subtracted, and this is with background subtracted. So you can see there's a burst here, then a multiple burst in here, then it starts to decay, and then there's another burst at the end here.
So is the attenuator in or out?
This is attenuator in. Yeah. We did leave the attenuator out last weekend. We caught 3 M-class flares in a row and filled our memory. It filled a 4 gigabyte memory. So if we leave it open, we have memory problems. Can't get the data down fast enough. Okay. So what I'm going to show you now is a time profile in several channels. So here's the event. The white one is 10 to 20 kilovolts. So you see this two peak structure. Then the next one is 20 to 40, 40 to 880 to 140. So 20 to 40 must be this guy. 40 to 80 is this guy. Is that right? And 80 to 140 is this. And I'm going to show you spectra here between these two, here and then here. There's the first one. Okay, this is clearly the thermal component down here. And then again, this double parallel shape. The break now is at 35 kilovolts. It goes from 1.9 down here to 3.2 up here. Okay. The second one, the two go from,
They're really a break.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's really a break. And knowing Bremsstrahlung, it's not easy to make a break, especially one that's as sharp as these. It goes from 2.389 to 5.5. Okay, here the break is splitting by 3 units at 24 kilovolts.
What? Is the energy the break similar from part to part?
No, this is at 24 kilovolts. This one's at 35, and the other one's at 45. Right. Yeah, because these are two spectra from the same flare.
These are the same flare. They're just
right.
Different
times. Right. Yeah, we haven't had a chance to actually do these things. The temperature probably does. Let me just see if I can interpret these numbers. This one, these are. This is probably. Let's see. Does this make sense? I'm sorry, I can't read these things. But you can see the spectrum is getting above 10 kilovolts. This is probably around 10 million or something. And this one, maybe a little more. Now this third one, they fit to a thermal, but I actually think it's better as a double parallel. If you look at the points here, these dashes are the points. So you see, like this and that. If it's thermal, it's enormously hot, 7 kilovolts.
The break energy that is at what?
Right here.
15, like
20. Yeah, okay, you can see what's happening if you
so
try.
The break energy is diminishing
time. I think it is, but I think these things are, they change. What's interesting, this is that same event. Remember it had two peaks, two main peaks. It came down and then second peak. This is a 10 to 12 to 25 kilovolt thing. This is a movie. And George and I were trying to figure out, you'll see the movie and you can decide for yourself. Okay, watch. Okay, you see it moved, all right? Now, see if you can tell when it moved in this thing, okay? What George was trying to tell me is when it moved, and then I tried to figure out where it was on this thing, okay? Yeah, so it moves about here. So suddenly the source changes, the location of the source changes. This is the event that was shown on the press release. This is Haiming's H alpha, right? Yeah. And the colored part is our stuff. So let's try looking at it again. I couldn't catch it, could you? Okay, so it's near the center of the sun. Okay, what's always amazed me is how tiny the thing actually is. There it goes. Now, I don't know that we got the registration right yet, because we weren't sure that the registration of the two images is correct. But the press people didn't care, they said. but anyway, I'm a little concerned, because it looks like our stuff is happening ahead of the H alpha. Does that look like? Okay, so. And the other thing, of course, is that I was talking to Haiming earlier. We need faster H alpha, because you're getting sort of one, and we get a whole bunch of things going by. And then,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We'll find a way to get around that. Yeah. So this is even slower. But you can see that it seems like our stuff is happening at one side, and it seems to precede the H alpha going across. But we need to get the registration right. So, okay, let me tell you a little bit about the data, because this is something. We released all of the data yesterday, day before yesterday, to the public. The data is available. As you can see it as fast as we see it, within 6 to 48 hours. And we actually provide software tools. I'm not saying the software tools are easy, but they are there, and we try to keep them updated so you can. Another thing to remember is this is photon-based imaging. It's not the same as making a picture and then bringing it down. We bring every photon down with its energy and time tag. When it gets down to the ground, you can decide what spatial, temporal, energy resolution, field of view, quality, imaging speed yourself. And I've just shown you one flare where we sliced it up, and you can see that when you slice it up different ways, you find different things. So it's not, we don't have to plan on how to operate the thing. The thing operates automatically, brings the data down. I just want to show you a few other spectra, because I thought this. Look at this. This is 8 orders of magnitude here. Here's a steep thermal spectrum. Right. This is a flare with the shutter out now. Okay. We think this is probably the iron line in here. We haven't really looked carefully yet, but that seems to be right. We still don't understand a response around 3 kilovolts yet, so be a little careful when you go to low energies. Ah, this is for Lars. There's a burst. It's either SIG X1 or something close to it. And the Earth occults SIG X1. Here's the occultation by the Earth. It's this stuff here. The previous and afterward orbits, they're sitting down here just as we'd expect. So we think this is the, we're collecting this transient.
What's your softest photon that can come from the side?
About 20 kilovolts. Yeah. It's aluminum. Yeah. This is the spectrum of that particular one. This is a count spectrum. We haven't corrected it, but the thing to notice is it goes well out to these 200 kilovolts. I don't know.
I don't think that other thing is spectra going beyond 100 kV.
Well, here it's very much beyond 100. I think it has been seen.
XT.
Yeah.
Yeah. XT
yeah.
XR.
Right.
XT.
Right. We also caught.
RXT.
Yeah. They have a scintillator. They have a scintillator array too. goes up to about 200.
It could go below 120, I guess.
Well, it gets to about 200, I think.
Does it get to
200? Yeah. This is the soft gamma ray repeater that we caught early on, where we only picked up 1 out of 8 photons. But this is the spectrum here. You can see it's much softer. So,
Is that fit by a thermal spectrum, or would it be quite a thin spectrum?
We haven't made the correction for the absorption yet. And so it's there, the data are there. This whole thing went by in 1.5 seconds. Yeah. And we only got 1 out of 8 photons. So that's why we stopped decimating, because we were afraid we'd lose more of these, right? We would have had 8 times as many photons in here.
That's kind of long. Usually it's 100 milliseconds.
Yeah. Well, I shouldn't say it's 1.5 seconds. We caught it in 2 1-second intervals. Yeah. I do have a time profile if you want to see that, but it's not in this PowerPoint present. Let's see. I think that's it for the stuff I had prepared. And you can see that we're at a very early stage in terms of, we finally sort of got the spacecraft almost operating, automated, and checked out its things. But of course, we've got data since February 12th when the detectors are turned on. And once all the final calibrations are made, we can go back to that data and then refine everything. So the data are already there. And it's meeting my expectations in the sense that there's a huge amount of stuff there. And we were hoping for that because we thought we would, we expected that when HESI got up, it would have so much data that there wouldn't be too much problem with data rights and stuff. We'd let people go and analyze the data. And I think that's going to be the case. Yeah.
And what's happening in the nuclear mining regime? Do you have?
We haven't seen any flares big enough. We've checked the. They're only they're sort of M-class flares, the biggest ones we've seen, and those were soft M-class flares. So we haven't seen any nuclear line emission yet. On the other hand, we haven't looked carefully for it either. We haven't done a search at 2.2 and things like that yet. These are just extra pictures. Okay, well, thank you.
So for auxiliary science, for a minute, to be sure I'm understanding roughly. So for most of the four priced irradiants, you've got roughly
20 kilovolts on it.
20 kilovolts and above.
20 kilovolts and above.
And the effective area is roughly what?
The detectors are 7.1 by 8.5. There are 9 of them, but some of them are going to block others in any given direction. So I think typically you've got about 200 square centimeters to any direction.
Right. And background in those is?
Background's relative. It varies by about a factor 3 from the equator to high latitudes.
Which is raw count rate.
Raw count rates.
That's what I've almost got.
Right. It's not as big as BATSE, okay, but it's probably, BATSE, I think one of their modules is about 800 square centimeters effective.
Yeah, about 1,000 square centimeters at 30 kilovolts.
Right. So we're not going to be as sensitive as BATSE.
We've got
resolution.
Every week there should be a burst for 10 days.
Yeah, maybe. Right.
But your raw count rate, 20 to 60 kilovolts, is just the background.
20 to 60. I know our totals were about a few hundred counts per second per detector.
Right. So.
And so 20 to 60 is maybe. I would say it's less than 100. It's probably. 50.
But I think for some things like it, they'll do better than that.
Right.
But it's slow going.
Lines. Right. Especially absorption. Yeah. Things that other people basically can't do. That's right. We'll be able to do that. Yeah. In terms of germanium, this is by far bigger than TGRS or anything like that.
I know the crab is going to be something.
Yeah, that's right. For the in June, the crab comes into the field. We will image the crab. It will be in our imaging field. We will image the crab with a few arc seconds resolution. And we've done some simulations. They look sort of promising. Okay. And so that should be the best imaging.
Any intensive polarization?
Yes. We designed this with, it's not really designed to be a polarimeter, okay, but it can do it because it's got this array of detectors and it's spinning. And what we did was to put a scattering block between some of the detectors and allow solar photons to get to that scattering block. Okay. You see this array of detectors. Let me see if I can see this getting blocked. Yeah, this is not it. But down below here is a small block of beryllium. And then photons from the sun are allowed to get into the beryllium. So of course, when they scatter near roughly perpendicular, they'll hit one of these five detectors and the spacecraft spinning. And so Mark McConnell at New Hampshire had a guest investigator proposal to analyze this. And he claims that in a big flare in the sort of 30 to 100 kilovolt range, we could measure polarization down to a few percent with this. Now, of course, measuring polarization is notoriously difficult. And we don't have the symmetry that you would like here, right? So this is just a simulation that's done. But we put that in because we thought the potential's there. And if the signal's bright enough, we'll see it. And of course, you can, at higher energies, you get scattering from detector to detector in sort of the 100 to 300 kilovolt range. And you can, Dave Smith did some simulations that said that we should be able to see tens of percent if there's polarization at that level. And Mark is actually also looking at whether we could see polarization from cosmic sources. I don't know.
Crab,
yeah.
How good is the timing in the sense that if I wanted to, thinking about the old stuff we did with X-ray pulsars.
Right. We time tag every photon to a microsecond. And I know Wayne Coburn has already looked at the crab pulsar, tried to pick the crab pulsar out. So we don't have as much area as Batsy, but I think the timing should be great. Yeah, so you may be able to pick out.
Yeah. So, I mean, with Batsy, the stuff we did was we were looking at one count per second and a thousandth count per second background.
Mm-hmm.
And we get, we would just depend on time to win. So, the contrast here is actually probably better.
Right. My guess is.
Even better is that we don't have this problem with the Nyquist. I mean, with Batsy,
that's right.
Second,
that's right.
Second.
No Nyquist problem because we're taking every photon now. Yeah, in retrospect, there are very nice things about taking every photon down. Really nice things. Yeah. The one problem we're having is we got too much data. We're filling the memory, and we can't bring it down as fast as we would like. So when we got caught with a few of these M-class flares with our shutter open, we filled the memory. And once we fill the memory, it takes us a while to empty it because it. At 4 megabits per second, to empty a 4 gigabyte memory is.
Does it stop recording data or does it override?
Right now, we've got it set so it stops recording. But right now, we're looking at modes that minimize, try to trim the data. Putting the shutter in immediately cuts out a lot of it. But then we may lose a lot of these tiny little things that are of great interest to us. So we sort of have to decide what to do.
Uh-huh. The first time I can see the reflected spectrum.
Yeah. Every time we look at some aspect of it, we think, hey, there may be some other things we can do. So it's really early in the mission, but things seem to be working well. One of the detectors has a leakage current problem, so its resolution isn't as good as the others. It still images, but it's It's still a lot better than scintillators, but it's still not as good as the other germanium. Other than that, when we get heavy cosmic rays going through the detector, it shuts it down for a small fraction of time. So these are minor issues that you have to deal with. But all the stuff we showed you up to now, we just sort of ignored that. Still.
Do you expect to have to worry about the degradation of the detectors over time?
We estimated that in the 2-year nominal life, that the degradation is pretty minimal. We actually built it so that we can anneal the detectors in flight, which means we could get rid of the radiation damage by heating the detectors up to 100 C. So our plan is to go through the nominal life and then see whether we need to anneal it. And if we do, we'll go ahead and anneal it. I know. It's
because you could get it looks a lot nicer than from solar than
Well, trace. Yoko, Hugh tells me Yoko's really dead. Yeah. They're not going to get it back. Yeah. Right. And SXI on GOES is up there now. And they're holding in the storage, but they could turn it on and give us soft X-ray images. But their cadence is only about 1 per minute. Okay, and as you can see, you know, things are happening fast. We really need fast data. We tried to get fast data from TRACE, and the flare that we imaged was one they only had 90-second data, so that doesn't help. But that's one of the things we wanted to work out, is to make sure that we get the H-alpha and the TRACE high cadence that we need to do this. Yeah. And we're hoping to get SXI up there, because TRACE, of course, is fairly low temperature stuff, even though they're beautiful images. And there's a, yeah, that's right, the 195. Right.
That's 20 million?
Yeah, it can be both
right.
A low energy and a high energy line falls in there, too.
Yeah, there's a high energy line.
Right.
That really does behave like it's 20 million.
Right. Yeah, and of course we're hoping that NOAA will decide to turn on the GOES SXI instrument to get
the
soft.
Resolution of that?
The spatial resolution? I think it's comparable. Maybe not quite as good as Yoko. Not quite as good as Yoko, but you know, pretty good. And it would get closer to our energy band, so we wouldn't. Yeah. Okay, but I one thing I would, you know, as I said, the data is there, the software is there, there are obviously exciting things to look at, so I think people should go ahead and try.
Thanks, Bob. Mm-hmm.